Breaking It Down with Frank McKay. This is 1039 LI News Radio.
I'd like to welcome everyone to Breaking It Down. Frank McKay here, but much more importantly, Dr. Glenn Berger is my very special guest. He's got a very well-known blog, and he's got a great book out, Never Say No to a Rock Star. Hey, Dr. Berger, how are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me, Frank.
Let's start right in with the book. What's the origin of the book? How did this all come about?
Well, presently I'm a psychotherapist, and I was working on a session with a guy who brought in some music that he wanted to play for me, and the song that he brought in was Aretha Franklin's version of Simon and Garfunkel's hit "Bridge Over Troubled Waters." And when we were listening to this together, I started feeling very, very emotional. And I didn't really understand what this was about, but it started bringing up old memories for me, because back in the 1970s, I had the good fortune of working at one of the greatest recording studios in the world, a place called A&R Recording in New York. And during that time, I worked with Paul Simon, amongst many other extraordinary artists. And listening to that version of Bridge Over Troubled Waters just started bringing up lots and lots of memories for me and lots of feelings, and so I started writing down those old stories to try to understand what those feelings were.
Very interesting. A&R Recording, who's the owner of that?
Phil Ramone was the owner of A&R Recording, and Phil he unfortunately passed away a couple of years ago. World-class, lifetime achievement, Grammy Award-winning recording engineer and producer, and he was my mentor.
Amazing. Yeah, I thought Phil Ramone owned A&R, but it was world-class studio. How did you get involved with Phil Ramone in the first place?
Well, I was lucky enough to get an internship there, and my first job, I finally got a job after interning there. My first job was as schlepper, and the schlepper was the guy who pushed a hand truck of tapes from their studio on 52nd Street and 7th Avenue in Manhattan to 48th Street between 8th and 9th. And this was across Midtown Manhattan in New York in the 70s, which, if you were around at that time, was quite a dangerous and grotty place. And that was my first job. And I, of course, aspired to be an assistant engineer. That was the next step up the ladder. So I'd get to the studio before everybody else and leave after everybody else and try to learn the craft. And when no one was around, no other assistants were around, they would let me cover a session, and I always screwed up. And it was a rough scene, and the senior engineers there would always yell at me quite brutally. And then one day, so I knew I wasn't ready. One day I got a call from the studio manager, and he said, everything is going to be okay. I said, what's wrong? He said, you're going to have to do a session with Phil Ramone. Now, if the other engineers were cruel and mean, Phil was the ultimate monster. He was known for eating assistant engineers for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And he worked with only one guy, his special guy. So I said, well, what about his assistant? He said, the guy's not available. I said, I can't work with Phil. They said, you're going to have to do it. So I called up my mother. I said goodbye because I knew I was going to die that night. I covered the session, and somehow my adrenaline was so pumped that I didn't screw up one thing. And I was just so happy to have survived the session. It was a session for Lucy Simon, who was Carly Simon's sister. Carly was there. Great studio cats were playing the instruments. And it was over in about 3 hours. And I just thought, this is great. I survived. I'll never have to work with this guy again. I went into the studio the next morning, and all the guys in the office were razzing me, as they usually did. And they said, oh, Berger is Ramone's guy now. And I said, screw off. I just did one session. They said, oh, no. And I went over to the book where all the sessions were scheduled, and there on all of Ramone's sessions was my name as the assistant engineer. The other guy's name was erased, and my name was there, and we were working with Paul Simon during the day and with an unknown artist named Phoebe Snow at night, and it was a singular moment in my life. It was an extraordinary thing.
I mean, that is extraordinary. Let me remind folks, if you're just turning on the radio or just tuning in to us, Glenn Berger, PhD. Glenn Berger is our very special guest. Dr. Berger there, and this is Frank McKay, but more importantly, Dr. Berger is the author of Never Say No to a Rock Star. Maybe you were even in on this session that Phil Ramone was talking about, but I remember a quote or a little story from Phil Ramone that I read somewhere, and it had to do with Billy Joel. And he said that Billy Joel's the type of person that if he gets something done quickly or gets something done easily, he doesn't believe it would be good. And he would go in and he would do a track. First track he did on a particular song, he said was, you know, Phil Ramone said was absolutely great, absolutely perfect. And Billy Joel just didn't believe that it could be. So foolishly, they erased it and they just never got the same feel again. And they just never got it and they were disappointed. And he learned after that with Billy Joel that if he gets a perfect track early, that he just keeps it. He just keeps it and he just moves on. Did you ever hear anything, along those lines of Phil Ramone and Billy Joel?
This was absolutely the key to Phil Ramone's magic. Phil was what made Phil extraordinary as a producer was that he was able to make the artist feel brilliant and created this perfectly safe environment where they could create. And Billy Joel is the perfect example of this, because before working with Phil, Billy was a sort of a middling artist. He had one minor hit. Nobody knew what to do with the guy. But Phil just let Billy be himself. And the next thing that happened was The Stranger and all of those extraordinary hit albums. And Billy is one of the top-selling artists of all time. So Phil always worked in that way, very spontaneously. We always recorded everything right from the beginning, hit that record button right away. You never know when the magic was going to hit. And he just, his goal was to have the technology be invisible. He didn't want the artists to ever know that they were being recorded, so they could just create. And very often we got takes very, very quickly that way.
Well, let me ask you, Dr. Berger, when you were schlepping, right? That was your gig, right? You're schlepping and you're schlepping these tapes all around. At that point, are you studying to be a psychotherapist? Are you thinking about it? Are you already there? What's the time frame?
Yeah, so I became the schlepper so this was 1973. I was 17 years old, and being a psychotherapist was the furthest thing from my mind at that point. I certainly
are you high school at 17 years old? Are you in high school?
Actually, yes, exactly. I started the internship when I was in my senior year at high school, and then I never went to college at that point. I went to college much later in life because my college was Screw University, the streets of New York City, and A&R recording studio, where I was very fortunate that in those days there was a traditional apprenticeship system. You know, we assistants worked under a master. I got to work under the tutelage of Ramone, who has an extraordinary legacy. There's almost nobody in the recording business who wasn't taught in some way by Phil Ramone. His fingerprints are all over everybody's great work that's coming out today.
No doubt.
I was lucky to learn that way.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's an Ivy League education if there ever is one.
And, absolutely.
And doing what you and I imagine your interest in psychology, and especially, you know, when you're mentioning that Phil Ramone and I mean legendary producer Phil Ramone, that he, you know, that he's, you know, involved psychologically. You'd have to be. I mean, to be a great producer like that, you'd have to have more than just just ears or you know, technical knowledge or whatever. I mean, you have to have some psychology there. Did any of that influence you on the way to becoming a psychotherapist?
That's a great question, Frank, because in fact, Ramone and many of the artists that I worked with were not only extraordinary in terms of the art that they made, but they were very often world-class lunatics. And I will very often say, kind of glibly, that one reason I became a psychotherapist was because I got most of the training that I needed by working with the nuts in the studio. So and Phil was definitely at the top of the list. He was brilliant, and he was a madman.
Was he a madman in the sense that he was like just super idiosyncratic, or was he unstable? I mean, what was the psychology behind Phil Ramone?
Well, Well, let me tell you one story that I think illuminates, give you the answer to that question. So we worked together on the New York recordings for Bob Dylan's album Blood on the Tracks, which was an amazing experience.
Amazing album, too.
Yeah, and actually, Dylan didn't show up for the remix. Very unusual. Most artists were very, very involved with every aspect of the production of their recording, but not Dylan. So it was just Ramon and me in the studio. It was about midnight. We were working 20-hour days at that point. In fact, we were working with Mick Jagger during the day and doing the Dylan thing at night. And so I rarely had an opportunity to ask Phil questions because there was usually an artist around and it just wasn't done. My job was to keep my mouth shut as the assistant engineer. But here was just Phil and I in the control room, and I saw he was doing something that looked a little unusual. So I asked him what he was up to, and he remained silent for a couple of seconds, and then he turned around with this look of purple rage on his face, and he started screaming at me, saying, "You don't ask Ramon a question. I am a god, and you are nothing. You will never be anything in this business. I am Phil Ramone, the god." And he must have thought that I was busting him for a mistake or something like that. I don't, you know. And I kept trying to say,
"Oh, he was serious. He wasn't.
He was serious. This was, we had been working together endless numbers. I lost it at that point. I just started blubbering. I went into the bathroom to, you know, pull myself together. I come out, I come back in the control room, and he's not in the control room. And I sit down at the console, and I see these little crumpled up pieces of paper on the console. And I unfold one, and it says, "Ramon is God."
Oh, my God.
I recrumpled the paper. I put it back on the console. I just go back to my stool, you know, where the assistant sits, and just think, I'm just going to sit here quietly. He comes back in the control room. He probably took a tranquilizer or whatever he did in those days, in a great mood, pretending none of this had happened, schmoozed me, got me back into, "Glenn, it's you and me. We're going to make great music together." You know, that was life with Ramon.
Yeah, I know. I remember now, you know, just thinking back, and I'm a music business junkie. And let me remind folks once again, if you're just tuning in, Glenn Berger, Dr. Glenn Berger, is the author of Never Say No to a Rock Star. And this is Frank McKay. Thrilled to have him. And you got all types of stories. You work with all the legends in the business. But I'm trying to think. Ramon was the R in that. Was it an Arnold? Was there an Arnold? He didn't last long, right? It was...
I'm impressed, Frank. That's you do know your trivia. Yes,
no,
the business guy was Jack Arnold. I never knew who he was. None of us ever did. But he was the A, and Phil was the R in A&R.
I know. Where was it located? Where was A&R located?
Well, originally they had a studio at 112 West 48th Street, but then Phil bought what was originally the Columbia Studios at 799 7th Avenue, which was at 52nd and 7th. It was this beautiful box that was put on top of the building, which was actually the Manhattan Community College. It was on the 7th floor. It had a peaked copper roof. If you go online, there's a couple of pictures of it. And it was a beautiful, the big room, A1, which was one of the studios on that side, was this gorgeous 30 by 60 by 90 room. It was legendary for its sound, and innumerable hits were made in that studio. And in fact, the reason that we did Blood on the Tracks there was because Dylan had recorded his original hits when it was Columbia's studio in that very room, and he wanted to return to that studio. And then we had another studio on 48th between 8th and 9th at 322 West 48th, where the Musicians Union is now. All the great studios in New York are gone. A&R and Media and Record Plant and all the legendary rooms are no more.
Did you guys have an 8068, a Neve 8068 in one of those rooms?
We eventually did. Back in the early 70s, A&R was kind of like the rest of New York City. It was sort of, we were flying in the ship like Han Solo ship. It was put together with bubble gum and rubber bands, and everything was custom made. and Ramon had his own concept. So the knobs on the console in A1 were in the shape of hearts, diamonds, clubs, and spades. And it had a very beautiful, warm, rich, clean sound. But eventually, we did get Neve consoles in all the rooms there, because those were, as you probably know from what you're saying, those are really the best.
Yeah, I mean, beautiful, beautiful boards and just incredible. People come from all over the place just to get onto one of them. What about guys like that? I mean, how technical did you get? Were you more into the music and to the artist, or were you more into the, the technology? Like, for example, it was Rupert Neve, right? I remember I was in a studio. What the hell was I? A unique studio, and someone said that Rupert Neve showed up, and the engineer ran down there with one of his modules to get his signature. I mean, ran down like Mickey Mantle was there or John Lennon was there. He ran down to get Rupert Neve to sign the damn thing. But what was it that made Phil, and I don't mean to focus all on Phil Ramone, but I mean, you knew him so well. What was it that made him great? We know what made him crazy. I mean, that sounds great. But connection to, in your mind, you know a lot of crazy people, and you know a lot of, I shouldn't say crazy, but you know a lot of very neurotic people, and if not psychotic people, and you know great artists and great talents. Any connection between the two?
Yeah, this is something that I obviously think about a lot, and in fact, I've presented at a conference called the Creativity and Madness Conference, which really examines this place where the creativity and the madness do come together. So it's a subject that I've thought a lot about, and I also had the great fortune to work on a movie called All That Jazz, directed by Bob Fosse. Which is semi-autobiographical and really is one of the best portraits of the madman artist and what drives them. So there's definitely a connection, and it's a really interesting question. But I think that for celebrities, very often there's a deep emptiness inside of them, along with that tremendous talent, and they try to fill that emptiness with fame. And when they get the fame, it sort of fills them for a moment, but it only leaves them with a greater craving, and that can never be filled. And that's why they turn to drugs or other things. And we haven't gotten the full story on what's going on with Prince, but it's just another story. There's so many guys, so many artists who suffer a tremendous amount. Ultimately, they're experiencing a lot of pain, and they're doing something that most people don't have the courage to do, to go into themselves and to put their work out there. And so I have nothing but compassion for artists, and I work with a lot of artists because they suffer a lot of pain,
Not to cut you off, but I want to remind folks that the name of the book is Never Say No to a Rock Star, and Dr. Glenn Berger is our very special guest. Thrilled to have him, Frank McKay, here, but more importantly, Dr. Glenn Berger is our very special guest. And, you mentioned, you're opening up all these doors here, all these memories, but you mentioned Bob Fosse, and you talk about a guy that, from what I understood, I never, had the pleasure of meeting him or Phil Ramone, but Bob Fosse was, from what I understood, was someone who just had so much insecurity about it and really greatness. I mean, the guy was just great at what he did, and I'm certainly no expert, but I remember a line, a story, an anecdote that was being told about Bob Fosse, and a friend of his finally said to him, he said, okay, look, you just won a Tony, a Grammy, and an Oscar all in the same year. Would you finally ease up on yourself? Can you congratulate yourself? Can you take a bow? And allegedly, Fosse said, it's amazing. Yeah, all of that happened, and they still haven't figured out that I'm a fraud.
Correct.
What is that? It's perfect guy to ask is you. Did you get to know Fosse very well? I mean, can you analyze him from just that one quote? Or is that him?
Yes, yes, absolutely. I did get to know him very well. We worked on that movie for, I worked on that movie for close to a year, and the last 4 months we were together 12, 16-hour days. So he was a consummate artist, and though in the movie he portrays himself as this reprobate, drug addict, sex addict, horrible to all the people closest to him, really he was beloved. He was beloved by anybody who worked with him, and I loved the guy. I thought he was really, he brought out more than the best in anybody that he worked with, and I feel so fortunate to have gotten to work with him. And he had his lines. There were the Flossy lines, and one of his lines was total self-confidence and total self-doubt. You know, and wow. that's the place that he lived. And again, it was this drive, this inner, this quest for something that he could never achieve. And I believe that all artists are frustrated in that way. In fact, Laurence Olivier said the same thing that Fosse said. He was being interviewed by Dick Cavett, and Dick Cavett said, "Do you ever get stage fright?" And he said, "I'm terrified before I go on stage every time." And he said, "You're the greatest living actor in Shakespeare. Why is this? Because this time they'll figure out I'm a fraud." And ultimately, in psychological parlance, we're talking about shame. Shame is the feeling that goes along with the belief that we don't measure up as a human being. And if you don't get the right stuff when you are a little kid, you live with that inner feeling that somehow you don't measure up. And some people think that if they're just spectacular enough, they'll finally get, you know, the love that they're seeking that they never got, or they'll finally get that feeling that they are actually worth something. But again, as Fosse revealed, you could win every award, and I think he was the only guy to do that, to win those three awards in 1 year, and still it doesn't fill you up. It doesn't take that insecurity away, and it's really a shame. It's a sad thing, because he was great, and it's too bad he didn't know it.
Yeah, just absolutely amazing. I need to take a quick break. Dr. Glenn Berger, everyone, is our very special guest. Frank McKay here. We'll be back right after this.